Welcome to the Nerd Closet, a podcast celebrating the mind of the gay man from high culture to pop culture. I'm Phil Putnam.
And I'm Joe Ferreira, and thank you for pressing play.
This week on the show, the record-breaking Kickstarter campaign for a Veronica Mars movie, how will it change Hollywood, and backlash to Ohio Senator Rob Portman's position switch on gay marriage. He may have switched because of his son, but was it too little and was it too late? Stay tuned for A-Side B-Side at the end of the broadcast.
Hi, Joe.
Hey, Phil.
How is your week going?
It's going very, very well,
actually. What's been happening?
Oh, just working and playing.
Uh-huh.
My normal New York self.
Okay.
But I wanted to share something,
please,
actually, that was kind of exciting. I flipped open my Time Out New York recently.
Time Out New York.
And
I love it.
And I went to their music section. I should say I arrived at their music section because
okay.
I go through all of it, but I go pretty quick.
Sure.
And I realized that there was a joint concert happening in New York of two artists that I love that I have brought in to talk about on this podcast.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, now that means like you're an arbiter of good taste.
Well,
and brings up like my musical competitive nature to try to now, you know,
exactly
have,
now you
like
need
more
to get
current
in
picks as well.
Well, I don't even know if it's current. I mean, honestly, they're a little bit surprising for me, but like, if I may read, they say read our primer on the rising pop starlet and avant-garde R&B auteur so you don't look like a fool to the too cool for school crowds at their next joint NYC show.
Wait, so which artists are they?
They are Sky Ferreira and How to Dress Well.
Okay, so remembering How to Dress Well, is that the one that your friend proposed with?
Yeah, and it's all like snapped.
Yeah.
Kind of like acapella-y, and then it
what
becomes,
was it called again? I'm Here for You, or I'm
and,
With You, or
And It Was You.
And It Was You. Okay, yeah.
And Sky Ferreira, she's out of LA. She shares my last name.
Uh-huh.
And she has a single called One.
One, one, one,
yeah.
One.
Yeah. It's a little robotic, but it keeps you dancing.
Yeah, it was really fun. Listen.
So I was really excited about that.
Okay.
In related news, I think I have permanently influenced Time Out New York. Because,
of course you have.
Because once upon a time, stop, how dare you. But once upon a time, I feel like they only used to list events for the upcoming single week. And I would always pick the magazine up when most of the events were already done. I would read it on Saturday, and the magazine covered like Monday to Sunday. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, great. I missed everything this week. So I wrote an angry tweet at them saying, you must cover...
You were an angry bird.
I was a very, very angry bird. And I said, you must cover 2 weeks at a time. And then sometime, like relatively soon after that, they did start covering 2 weeks.
And now they're covering the artists that you cover here.
I know. So they're obviously paying very
Clearly,
close attention.
Time Out New York is listening to the Nerd Closet.
Oh my goodness. You're in good company, listeners. All right. That's
well, no, I have to give a shout out to Adam Feldman, who's one of the theater critics at Time Out New York. He's a buddy of mine, and we run into each other at cabarets around town all the time, and super nice guy. And so he's one of the Time Out New York writers,
and
we
I
adore him.
Sure. And I remember when I first moved here, asking people, like, how do you know what's happening? The city is so mm-hmm. big. And universally, people usually would say, well, you got to pick up
this. It is kind of like a survival guide.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah.
You know? So, well, my week's been good.
Mm-hmm.
A normal, crazy work week, which I love. I love that with this current job that I'm in, at the end of my day, and especially at the end of my week, I feel like wrung out like a sponge. I feel utilized, and I feel like my mind has been pushed to its capacity. So,
because you like a challenge.
Yeah, well, and I like feeling utilized. I like feeling productive and like I'm making a contribution. So I'd much rather be worn out by my job than being a job that I feel like doesn't make the most of what I have to offer.
Hmm.
So each day I really am increasingly worn out as I get towards Friday.
Right.
But then there's this great sense of release and accomplishment that comes on Friday.
And I know you love that sense.
I do.
Yes.
I do. I've been fighting bronchitis
for
the past week. So you can hear like a little bit of the remnants of that. But it's the hag wheeze is gone from my from my lungs. And then, like, I guess the other highlight of my week has been that as I'm wrapping up the mixing on my new album, I've had some more available creative thought to start going back towards my musical.
Oh, good, yes.
And so there's a batch of a few songs I need to finish up, and then I'll be done with the whole first draft of all the songs for the show, which is really, really exciting.
That's nice.
So I've been struggling for the past several weeks to really have some available creative space to devote to the musical.
Some bandwidth.
Really? So, yeah, some creative bandwidth, you know, some attention. And now I have that. And so one of the songs, one of the new songs I'm writing for it that has been mulling in my brain since probably since November is now really starting to take shape. And so I'm really excited that this, you know, it's weird because as an artist, even as a songwriter, I've been doing this for so long and I know I can write a song. But still, when you have those phases where you can't make any progress, you really do freak out. Like, it's the have I lost it moment.
Right. No, yeah. And now this is your first musical.
Yeah.
And I was thinking you and Cyndi Lauper should get together and compare notes.
Seriously.
Because she's doing her first musical right now.
So she
is. I think you would both get a lot out of it.
Yes. She's doing the Kinky Boots
on
the Broadways right now. Harvey Fierstein, did he write the book?
Probably.
I think he wrote the book and he might be directing it. I should probably know this. Bad gay.
We should probably know this.
Bad gay Phil. Well, you work in theater.
I am. Okay. We'll run a correction next week, everyone. Don't worry. You'll get the details eventually.
Exactly. Let's do Veronica Mars.
Okay, we'll go there.
Okay, so I am a huge Veronica Mars fan. Have been for several years.
And I have never seen it.
Okay. Netflix it. Watched instantly. Just get her done. Incredible.
What? Everyone loves the show so much.
So, not what you would expect from a CW show about a blonde girl detective.
Right.
Right? It sounds really, really bad, but it's very much modern teenage problems. Like, it's about basically a girl whose boyfriend broke up, or she broke up with him, so he was upset, so he sent out a sex video to all of his friends through the cell phones. The cell phones, I sound so old. Through their cell phones at high school. Like, that's the kind of stuff Veronica Mars deals with. They don't deal with, like, you know,
these are modern issues.
1980s kid stuff.
Like, no.
This is, like, 2007 issues, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, longer story shorter, but had a really passionate fan base since it got canceled in 2007. And there's been talk about a movie for a long time. Well, they launched a Kickstarter campaign on, I want to say, Tuesday or Wednesday of this week. And the deal was that if they could raise $2 million among their fans in 30 days, Warner Brothers, who owns the television show, would then cover the cost of marketing, distribution, and promotion for a film. And it would be primarily digital distribution, but then they would do a selected theatrical run in a few cities. And if they could raise the money, then Warner Brothers would pick up the rest of the tab.
Mm.
Well, they raised $2 million online in 11 hours.
Right.
And then now, as of this moment, they have about 28, 27 days left to raise additional funds, and they're already almost to $3.4 million. So what it did is not only did it verify and validate all of us crazy Veronica Mars fans that have been out there talking about this show for years, but it really opened up a new discussion about new possibilities of funding and distributing films from the Hollywood perspective. So I'm curious to talk about that and see your thoughts, because I can see the gleam in your social media eyes.
Right. Okay. So I feel like everything I've been reading online has been talking about either crowdfunding or 3D printing. So we'll save 3D printing for another time.
Sure.
But in terms of crowdfunding, Amanda Palmer also just had her big, I think, more than $2 million fundraising success.
And she's been a social media, you know, savant. She came from the Dresden Dolls. And then now she's, you know, Amanda Palmer as a solo artist for several years. And so that's been her bag.
And so this is definitely in the news. But I think what's fascinating is she definitely plays the part. Whether or not she has an indie artist's reach, she presents herself as a very indie artist. Mm-hmm. And so from what I've been reading and from what just I think, it makes sense that she would go to a crowdfunding platform like Kickstarter and that would be like her source of income. Switching from indie artists and, you know, developers who want to like make a new app or whatever into studio films is sort of crazy, because I start imagining that there's going to be profit beyond, like excessive profit beyond just the cost to create the album. You know what I mean? If it's a musician, I think they have to cover the cost of their album. But then since they're indie artists, like, they're probably not going to be rolling in it afterwards. Whereas if all of corporate America and all of the Hollywood studios start kickstarting every project they do, like imagine if Transformers 4 is like, hey, everyone, here's the Kickstarter. I mean, I don't really know who'd kickstart that, but then I maybe start having a problem. If someone is going to get like too rich at the other end, then I become like sort of suspicious of it, especially if it's not really just like a small group of people or one person trying to achieve a project.
Well, I think from the Hollywood perspective, the value of the Kickstarter campaign isn't financial. Like Warner Brothers could put down, I mean, please, $2 million for
they
a
don't
film.
Care.
That's nothing to them.
Okay.
This was about verifying the audience for them.
Okay.
Nobody in a Hollywood studio wants to take a risk.
Right.
No one wants to take a financial risk, let alone a creative risk. They all want to make money back. So this was their way of verifying that the base audience was there.
Mm-hmm.
And not only was it there, but we kicked some serious ass in 11 hours. I mean, this was mind-blowing. And the HollywoodReporter.com had a really good article about this. And another one of my favorite TV shows, Pushing Daisies,
right.
Their creator and executive producer, Brian Fuller, had a comment in the article. And he said, you know, right away, I reached out to my agent to see, could we do this for Pushing Daisies? And the agent's response, which was no, because you couldn't make a Pushing Daisies movie for $2 million. So a thing like Pushing Daisies, it's much more about special effects and prosthetics, and also all their iconic sets would have to be rebuilt because they were struck after the show was canceled. With Veronica Mars, it's basically its strength
you
is
need a
the
high school.
Characters
oh.
and the writing, and there's really no large production costs. And then the actors, including Kristen Bell, who plays Veronica, who's relatively large star now, you know, she's going to work for peanuts, and the whole cast will work for basically nothing to make the film, and so will the creators. So in terms of pulling it off financially, this was an ideal project to make it happen.
Right.
The question of could something like Pushing Daisies raise $10 million through Kickstarter, I don't know, because you're still dealing with the cult fan base who may not be as large, so their average donation cost would have to be higher.
Does anyone know what the average? Do you know what the average donation cost is?
I do, because I'm such a crazy fanboy.
Oh my gosh! Well,
I know it as of the moment that they had 1.9 million. Because I literally on I think it was Tuesday night, either Tuesday or Wednesday, I literally sat and watched the numbers just rise for an hour.
Oh my gosh!
It was like better than watching TV, and then I videotaped it on my phone. When it
Bill,
clicked
I
over
can't
to 2 million.
That.
Yeah.
I can't believe. Wait, no.
I'm such a fanboy for Veronica Mars.
Right, and I don't think I understood how much until that moment, because a lot of people walk around being like, OMG, the new normal, I'm obsessed, or whatever.
Yeah.
And I like kind of am like,
Yeah.
You know, people say everything's awesome, whatever, you get it. But if you filmed.
I filmed it.
The Kickstarter, like, meter flipping over 2 million, then that's.
Well,
I would have never suspected
here's
that.
Here's part of why I did that, though. It is absolutely because I'm a pathetic, devout fan of this show.
Right.
But also, I was tracking it all day long from the moment that I saw it in the morning online, because I thought this
it's
is
going to
be something. Like when they reached 500,000 in 3 hours, I'm like, okay, this is something. And because I work in social and digital, I thought this is a paradigm shift. This is going to become a story. This is a moment.
Right.
So I was just really fascinated with this whole thing. And then sure enough, anything that makes that much money that quickly, Hollywood studios are going to take notice.
Sure.
And they're going to start thinking, can we do this for other shows that have had a similar situation where limited run on TV, but really committed fan base. So that's part of why I videotaped it. And
for that historic moment of like the world change, like the model changing.
Yeah, and I
from
can't,
one to
I another. Can't say this is going to be an entire model change, but I certainly felt confident that the conversation that's now happening
right.
was going to happen as a result of this.
Right.
And so I'm fascinated to see where it goes. I think that maybe more filmmakers will be emboldened. And as far as your comment about being upset if major studios use this to make money. Well, the thing is, like, whether I support a film financially through Kickstarter or whether I go to the box office and buy a ticket, I'm not bothered by the fact that my money is helping support that film, nor am I feeling gypped because I'm not making a financial return off of the ticket that I purchased. Like, we don't expect that. So it doesn't really, if I choose to go see a film, it seems silly of me if I was going to be upset that that film was then being financially successful.
Right, right, right. No, I wouldn't be upset that it was financially successful. I guess I'm just saying, like, when you get into like a crowdsourced thing, like part of me would be like happier. This is crazy. If you could fund the entire thing through crowdfunding and then it like became everyone's again. I don't even know what political, I don't even know if this is right or left wing. Like, I don't know what.
Well, I mean, crowdfunding is about participation at the individual consumer fan level. So that's what defines it as a model. So in that way, it is everyone's. And the genesis of this film.
But it wouldn't be. Know, yeah, but it would be like everyone's to pay to see it again.
I guess. I don't understand what you're trying to say.
I'm saying, like, what if there was like a crowdfunding project? I scooped on that word. A crowdfunding project that then at the end it was like, this movie's free. Like, go to veronicamarsmovie.com and just get it.
Well,
for
everyone that participated, that donated to the project, it is free for us.
What?
Yes.
Oh, you didn't say that?
Well, of course. Like, I'm sorry. Maybe I assumed that. Okay, this is a good reminder.
Okay.
The basic concept of crowdfunding is that you are invited to financially support a project before it's created, and in return, you get customized special rewards that are only available to people that financially support the project. And part of those rewards is always the product itself. And then there are things on top of that that get more and more grandiose as the amount that you donate goes higher.
Got it.
So, like,
the minimum here was give
is
this
a
much,
digital version of the film.
You
when
get
it's
the
released.
Digital version of the film.
Yeah. Got oh it. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's
so
the motivation that's built in to be a part of crowdfunding. Besides getting to be a part of the experience, you actually get the product.
Okay. Well, I'm glad I asked.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm glad I drove that all the way off the cliff.
Yes.
And let it explode.
Yes. And dear listeners, I'm sorry if I assumed that everybody knew what crowdfunding was. We would love to hear your thoughts on this. I think this can become a really fun conversation. So tweet us your thoughts and ideas, and also other TV shows you might want to see made into movies this way. God. Or I know if you're a Firefly fan, you want a Firefly movie.
Everybody's
like
waiting for it. Yeah.
Crazy. And I want a Pushing Daisies movie. And I know Chuck fans, the NBC show Chuck, you're all crazy about Chuck. So you want a Chuck movie. So tweet us at Phil Putnam Music and tell us what you want, or tweet Joe
at Joe Redhead.
Awesome. And to all my other VMARS fans out there, we won.
So this very past week, Senator Rob Portman changed his position on gay marriage.
Portman's a Republican.
Yes, he is. Yes. Everybody. And the right, we should say the position shift was from being anti-gay marriage to now being pro-gay marriage. Mm-hmm. And he cited the reason as his son, who came out a few years ago. He's now
2 years ago.
Yes, yeah. 2 years ago. The son goes to Yale, came out to his dad. Dad spent some time thinking about that and has decided that his son now deserves the same rights as everybody else. Mm-hmm. And although there's been this like train of Republicans switching their vote, I mean, not a literal vote, but switching to the pro-gay marriage side of this issue recently, Senator Rob Portman got a little bit of flack because people said he waited until his son came out of the closet for him to actually switch, instead of being sensitive enough to recognize that other people have children too, and other people have feelings too, and it didn't have to wait until he himself was directly affected.
Yeah. Okay, and also to put this into further context, this is coming on the heels of like a 2-week wave of several other Republican lawmakers and power brokers in government, federal government, reversing their stance. So he's a little bit late to the game, and I think that's affecting the perception of it for him. And then also, it's just a few days from now, from today when we're talking about this, the Supreme Court's going to hear arguments on the federal case to overturn the Defense of Marriage Act.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as his voting record on, you know, marriage equality and gay rights goes, he is deplorable.
Right.
from a pro-gay rights standpoint. He's been deplorable. he did vote in support of the Defense of Marriage Act, which amended the Constitution to only make marriage legal for one man and one woman. He also voted in favor of a ban on adoption for gay parents in either Ohio or Michigan. I can't remember which. Probably Ohio, which is where he's he's a senator. And then he, of course, you know, voted, you know, against every possible gay rights option over the past, well, probably all of his tenure in public office.
So he's been consistent.
He's been consistently against us.
Yes.
And then his son came out 2 years ago. And I have to say this, like, I have mixed feelings on it. First of all, I'm not going to look a gift horse in the mouth.
Sure.
I'm just going to saddle up and ride it hard.
Okay.
So, like, I'm going to say thank you. That's one less voice in opposition to us and one more name that stands out from switching positions on that.
Right.
And thanks. Thanks for that. We appreciate it. However, I do think that deciding that your child deserves basic human rights doesn't get you any extra points in parenting. That is not exceptional.
Right.
That is not meritorious. That is base level. And I think it's despicable for him to even suggest that this is somehow, you know, a really wonderful, empathetic thing for him. That's fucking bullshit.
Wow. So
I think that it's really deplorable that it took him this long. And I think the idea that he should get extra credit for treating his son like a full human being is so fucking bullshit.
Well, I even think, I mean, you said he's late to the party in the sense that all these Republicans have switched views already. Well, I think he's a little bit late to the party by waiting 2 years from when his son came out. Like, I would hope that that could have happened, like, at least a month or so. You know what I mean? Like, I'll give him a few. I understand that, like, times are kind of baked into you and there are viewpoints that are hard to change, and I totally like respect that up to a point. And maybe I shouldn't, maybe I'm being too lenient, but I would have given him a few weeks to like adjust or cool down or like, you know, come around on it. But 2 full years is kind of a long time.
Well, I mean, I have to say this, I, as much as I think it shouldn't have taken him this long to stop being a bonehead parent, I can't ever feel comfortable placing time restrictions on someone else's personal development.
Okay.
They develop as they develop.
Sure.
And I'm glad that he's arrived where he's arrived. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of where I stand on that. But you know, he's been rooted in his faith, which comes from an anti-gay stance for, you know, a long, long time, 50, 60 years. That takes a long time to undo, even when it's your flesh and blood that has prompted you to reconsider this. So
right. It
took him however long it took him. He did write a column, an editorial in the Columbus Dispatch. And I want to actually read a couple comments from that, because it's very, I think it shows an interesting perspective on what his change has been.
All right.
So here's a quick quote. He said, I don't support allowing gay couples to marry because I'm a conservative. Or sorry, let me read this fully proper. British Prime Minister David Cameron has said he supports allowing gay couples to marry because he is a conservative, not in spite of it, and I feel the same way. We conservatives believe in personal liberty and minimal government interference in people's lives. News to me. We also consider the family unit to be the fundamental building block of society, blah, blah, blah. And then he said this, we should encourage people to make long-term commitments to each other and build families so as to foster strong, stable communities and promote personal responsibility. That interests me, because what this tells me is that potentially his shift has also to do with his definition of what a family unit is. Because
okay.
So much of the consternation about gay marriage and about gay adoption is people suggesting that gay families are not real families. And he's basically saying gay marriage strengthens the family unit. So this also suggests a shift in the idea of the perception of the value and the meaning of gay families in the context of America.
Saying that they're treated more equally, that they're viewed as legitimate.
Yeah, that there's perhaps been a shift in what he sees about gay families and not just gay marriage. Because for him, marriage is about family.
Right.
And then I also want to read this. He said, one way to look at it is that gay couples' desire to marry doesn't amount to a threat, but rather a tribute to marriage. and a potential source of renewed strength for the institution. Now, I do have to tell you, while I personally don't have a desire to be married to my partner, I can tell you that any desire to be married has not come because straight marriage has been such a shining example of the strength of the institution.
Right.
Cut the shit. Like, straight marriage is a fucking joke. It's a mockery of what marriage is supposed to be on the whole. Like, the number of reasons you can get straight married that have nothing to do with love and commitment in America are legend.
And you're talking about financial reasons.
Financial, because you're drunk, to win a bet, to win a dare, to spite somebody, whatever.
To get famous.
There's no reason that you have to give for getting married in America. Yeah, it's ironic that you have to give a reason to get divorced.
Right.
But you don't have to give a reason to get married.
Well, do you think, from an economic standpoint, that it is better somehow that the building blocks of the nation are more secure if we're in family units instead of all singles dating each other, getting around?
Well, I'll say this. Okay. I think that the state supports marriage because it's better for the state. The reason why the state allows anything legally is because it's financially and security-wise better for the state. That's the base motivation.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason why marriage is legal for straight couples is because the blending of assets and the shared financial responsibility means that the spouses and the families take care of each other. This is the base idea. You have to kind of walk out the scenario a little bit. But the base idea is that it's fewer people for the state to support.
Got it.
If they're financially entangled with each other.
I see.
And that's also the base motivation behind community property and alimony and child support. So I think when it comes down to the financial aspects and the straight up legality aspects of marriage, the state makes their decisions in the state's interest. Gay marriage is different because it's primarily been a morally fueled argument.
Yes.
And that's proven out by the fact that people are seeing change in the argument now that moral positions are changing on it.
I totally hear that. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting. I've read two things talking about gay marriage and then the other on gay divorce, actually, mm-hmm. and describing them as landmine places to increase productivity and boost the economy in different regions. And I know that when New York City passed its marriage equality bill, that was a huge joke because everyone was like, the next 2 years, think of all the gay weddings, think of all the money that's going to be spent. Like, this is a great thing for prosperity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that you bring up a good point, which is that whenever you have the opportunity to marry, you have to consider the opportunity to divorce.
Yeah.
And I remember 5 or 6 years ago, actually, no, maybe this was more like 7 or 8 years ago, talking with a friend of mine from my hometown, and he was in a situation where he had been legally married to his partner in a different state, and they now had to – oh, no, you know what it was? It was that they had been registered as domestic partners in California.
Oh, yes, yes.
In the domestic partner registry. So this is prior to 2008. And what they didn't realize is that if they wanted to break up, they had to get legally divorced. So they did not have full marriage rights, but they had full divorce responsibilities, including alimony. And, you know, it just was one of those things where it really fucking pissed me off.
Yeah.
You know, and it still pisses me off that we not only do gay men and do not have marriage rights, but we have full divorce responsibilities and we have full tax responsibilities. Like, my basic beef with a limitation on gay rights is financial. It's tax. It's that I pay for the same America that my straight counterparts do, and I don't get the same America back.
Right. And that's fair enough.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Exactly. Wow. And that's how Phil sees it.
That's how I see it. Damn it.
Pumping it out there. Well, no, and the divorce question is interesting, and of course nobody wants to talk about it, but it is inevitable, right, and is coming in one way, and has already occurred, I'm sure. But yeah, there's this interesting thing where if it's not federally recognized, one thing that I did read was you have to go back and visit the same state. So even if you've moved away, like now you live in Pennsylvania, but you were domestic partnered in California, you will have to revisit California in order to conduct that separation because Pennsylvania won't do it for you.
And and this is something I'm actually glad we can talk about here because it's something I've had a lot of one-on-one conversations with my gay friends about, and I would love to share it with a larger audience, which is this. It's just a caution. It's just something to be aware of for our gay friends, gay men and women who have the desire to be legally married in the United States. It's that right now there is a difference in legality between the states you can get married in and federal. Mm-hmm. And that creates a significant amount of confusion for you when it comes to taxes. So it's probably going to be potentially another 10 or 15 years until federal tax law and state tax law are fully ratified with each other when it comes to gay marriage. Because of this, it's highly likely that same-sex couples who are married are going to have to spend a significant amount of additional expense on legal and financial and tax preparation to work out the differences between these two things until the government gets their act together and fully works it out. Mm-hmm. So just please have that in mind. I think it's great if you want to get married, but just understand that you are signing up for an additional set of issues that you're going to need to work out. And just prepare for that financially, prepare for it mentally and emotionally, and talk through with your fiance, with your potential spouse, how you might deal with that when it comes, because it's probably going to be a part of your marriage experience for quite a while. Are you ready for A side, B side?
I'm so ready.
Yay, side, B side.
Okay, so this week I am bringing in a total sugar pop. Oh my goodness, it's so bubblegum.
Pour some sugar on me.
Yeah, it's like straight off of like a radio. It's a great summer song. Actually, I'm going to introduce it this way. I'm calling the 2013 Song of the Summer as Gold by Brit Nicole.
I'm loving this. I'm loving your confidence.
Have you heard of this girl?
No.
Okay, I'm going to play this song for you and just imagine it pouring out of like a car window, like an open rolled down car window as it like drives through the hot summer streets. I think that this is going to be the like energizing song of 2013.
I'm ready for the challenge. Yep, okay. This is Brit Nicole Gold.
Gold.
Got it.
Gold.
Gold. But not platinum.
But not platinum, really?
I have to say, like, it's fun. It's fun. Here's the thing. Here's the reason why.
Okay, tell me.
I think that it could be the summer song if something with a stronger chorus doesn't come along. Because the summer song is all about the chorus, and that chorus is not the strongest.
Okay.
And the other thing is that I have a hard time imagining people over a certain age making that their song. I think it's a fun song, but I think it's kind of a kid song.
Well, like, Call Me Maybe. You think any age was available to Call Me Maybe?
I think Call Me Maybe has a little bit of a wider age range than Gold does.
Okay.
I think it's a fun listen. I do. And I think it's not breaking any ground, which is fine. We need songs that just, like, tread the same ground or just a pure fun listen.
Exactly.
I just think, like, it's 80% there to being the summer song. And I think it's a little too early in the year. Still plenty of time for a new summer party song to come along.
And she is unknown, right? Like, maybe if someone with a little bit of a bigger name had put this out, like, it would have had more of a chance, but...
Maybe, yeah. I have to say, I don't know if I can see any of the established pop stars taking this summer song, though, honestly. I don't think this is going to be a Katy Perry summer, or it's going to be a Britney summer or something. I think that there's going to be a new girl like this coming in and giving us the song of the summer.
Right.
I'm just not sure this is it.
Well, be on the lookout, because I've picked mine, so it's up to you now.
Okay, got it. Well, my song certainly will never be the summer song ever, and it's actually not even new. I love going back and listening to back catalog, and this is a song by one of my favorite songwriters of all time. His name is John Bacchino, and he is known to like the New York theater and cabaret community, and then, you know, people that listen to cabaret type, you know, standard songs around the world and around the country really appreciate him, but he's not known by many large standards, but I've worshipped him. He's just such an incredible writer, and he did a record called Grateful, which features several different cabaret and theater stars of varying levels of celebrity. And like, it's got some big names like Patti LuPone and Kristen Chenoweth on it, as well as some other really wonderful cabaret stars like Anne Hampton Calloway and Brian Lane Greene. So something for everyone, regardless of what level of theater you love. Everything on this record really, really moves me. And this song in particular, which is called In a Restaurant by the Sea, and it's sung by Anne Hampton Calloway, is honestly one of my top five favorite songs, any artist, any writer, any era. This song is one of my biggest favorites, and it came up in conversation with some friends recently, and I've been going back to this song, and I really am excited to share it, because it's a really special piece of music. So this is In a Restaurant by the Sea, written by John Bacchino and performed by Anne Hampton Calloway.
In a restaurant by the sea, on a liquid afternoon, for a moment eyes collide, and the world's periphery, now your pupils learn. Dream with a wine wagon.
How very somber.
You think it's somber?
I mean,
it's slow.
It's slow. But yeah. I mean, and it's very peaceful.
Oh, I love it so much.
It's beautiful. The bass and the piano, like the left hand is very active.
Yeah.
Much more active than I think I'm used to hearing.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of what makes it interesting is that it's a very romantic love song and you're not used to hearing the movement in the bass hand.
Mm-hmm.
You're used to it coming from the right hand and being all flittery and stuff. And John just has that ability to kind of turn things on its ear. And then Anne, I mean, I don't know if she's your flavor of voice. I just think she's one of the most beautiful vocal interpreters.
Oh, she's very nice. Yeah.
You know, so I have to say what moves me so deeply about that song are two things. The first is that it's just so romantic and sensual. I can completely picture the situation in my brain.
Yes.
But also, this song, and I think every song on this record, was written by someone who clearly has experienced these things. And I think there's such a deep, like, knowing in this record that I almost feel like John spent 20, 30 years living these things and then wrote about them. And so, you know, I hear that a lot in music, but to hear it so deeply through an entire record is something really special. So I'm very attached to this and also very attached to this specific song.
Sure. And do you feel like you want to learn from him or adopt any of his styles into
your
music?
I do. Yeah. Actually, okay. I cover this song every once in a while in my live shows.
Yeah.
I haven't played it in a long time, like a few years, but I think I'm going to bring it back into my routine. Yeah, I think that there's a way that he expresses himself that I definitely want to learn from. And then also, he and I have sort of a melancholy in common.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate that about him. I mean, everything I write is very contemplative and has a little bit of melancholy to it.
Mm-hmm.
Even like my happy songs, you know, like they're thoughtful happy songs. So I definitely appreciate the way that he uses melancholy. And it teaches me about how I could possibly shape mine further.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's In a Restaurant by the
beautiful.
Sea.
It was really, it's really nice.
Oh, I love it so much. And like, the thing is like, that's a moment I want.
Yeah.
Like that's a moment I want with my partner. Like I want to have that kind of moment. So that's part of why I love it so much.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody, for listening to
Yay!
This week's Nerd Closet podcast. I'm Joe Ferreira.
And I'm Phil Putnam. And tweet at us. I'm at Phil Putnam Music.
And I'm at Joe Redhead.
Thanks for listening.
See you later. Bye.